Well, look, will you, at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 31, the opening sentence of that final paragraph of the chapter, where the apostle writes this: whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Now, that's how you understand the Christian, he says. That is his or her motivation. Do it all for the glory of God. So whether you eat or drink, he says, those of you who know the letter will know, these last couple of chapters have been wrestling with an issue about food offered to idols. It was a real problem in Corinth then, as it is in parts of the world for Christians today. Do you eat or don't you? And you press him for an answer and you want it nice and clear, and the answer seems to come back, yes, eat, unless it's no. And you try him again because you think if anyone's going to give you a black and white answer, the Apostle Paul will. And he says, yes, you're free to eat, unless, in which case, no. And you think, is he being inconsistent? Is he being two-faced? And really, he says, no, you're asking the wrong question. See, the big deal question is not, do you eat the food or don't you? It's, do you glorify God or not? Ask that question. Oh, the answer is very consistent. Yes, yes, yes. Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Well, thank you very much, Hugh, says someone. This is Workplace Sunday. I know London is a cosmopolitan city, but I didn't think that food offered to idols was a big problem in many workplaces here. And it's not. But you see what this sentence says. We've had two chapters about this problem, and then he says, whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. He applies it far more widely than just to this problem. Now, I was chatting with someone earlier this week, and I was talking with him about how he works out his Christian faith in his workplace. And after a bit of umming and ahhing, he said to me, well, I try to work for the glory of God. And that was fine. But the trouble was, I was researching for this sermon, so I couldn't really let it go there. And I said, yeah, but tell me, what does that look like? Oh, he said, well, if the subject comes up, I want to be ready to tell my colleagues about Jesus. And it was great that the idea was on the radar screen. It didn't sound as if it came up very much, and I was still pushing further. I said, yes, but what about your actual work? Well, he told me about a lawyer in a firm of lawyers, a Christian lawyer, who'd made it his practice to make sure he encouraged, had a word of encouragement with at least someone in the firm every day, because no one else ever seemed to bother to encourage them. And what a difference that had made and how it had struck him. And he was trying to be like that as well. And in one of my more pastorally clumsy and inept moments, I said, I see, so you're really trying to be nice in the workplace, are you? And, as we talked a little further, this idea of working for the glory of God, we realized it was a phrase that resonated, and yet when you tried to tie it down, it got so hard. You know, we say it, we nod when someone else says it, but what are we expecting when we talk about working for the glory of God? Times, aren't there, when it can feel like trying to nail jelly to the wall. So this morning, I just want to try and see if we can bring a bit of substance to that idea. Two or three ideas just to put into the mix, if you like. Here's the first of them. God's glory reveals God's nature. God's glory reveals God's nature. The Old Testament word for glory actually has got the idea of weight, of heaviness, of worthiness. God's glory is his worthiness. Do you remember in the Old Testament, back in Exodus 33, when Moses says to God, "Now show me your glory," as if it could be seen? And if you remember that story well, you'll know that the only seats in the house that Moses could get were those with a restricted view, as if too much of his glory would be too much for us to see. But glory wasn't something vague. As part of it, God said, "I will proclaim my name." He didn't mean he was going to go through a list of all the names for God. wasn't going to be like those wedding services where you suddenly discover the obscure middle name someone's got. You know, as they say, I, Melinda Chamomile Hendry. Now we know why she never told us that's what her name was. And so on. No, actually, when God proclaims his name, what he says is this: the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin, yet he does not leave the wicked unpunished. His name turns out to be his character. God's glory turns out to be his character. Do it all for the glory of God in some way reveals God's nature and character. Or, you remember the psalmist? The heavens declare the glory of God. And so often in the Psalms, the second line tells you what the first really is all about. The skies, that's what the heavens are. They're the skies, not the after you die place. The skies proclaim the works of his hands. Look at the skies. See the creative power of God. The sun shining through, the moon, the stars. You'll have to go out of London if you want to see them. But they're there every night. The wow of the scope and the color of the skies. And here we are, thousands and thousands of years later, with the aid of space discovery, we would add the planets, the galaxies. As Philae, the space comet lander whose solar batteries are just starting to recharge, as Philae sends information earthward in the next weeks and months, don't you hope that at least one of the scientists receiving all that information is going to say, wow, the power of the God who brought all this into being, the glory of God. Here's another line very familiar to all of us from Christmas time, if nowhere else. The Word became flesh and made his dwelling among us, and we have seen his glory. Later on, John would say, not just seen it, heard it, touched it, felt it. Now, we're not Jesus, of course, and we're not the heavens, but it's good to remember what company we're keeping when we talk of working for the glory of God. And what substance there is behind others who point to and reveal his nature and his worthiness. God's glory is God's nature revealed. To work for the glory of God is not to add to his glory. I can't possibly do that, nor can you. But it is to go public on God's worth. God's glory is God's nature revealed. It changes Monday morning every bit as much as it changes Sunday morning. And you see, in case there's any danger of us backing off, come back again and look at our verse, will you? Whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. It's the apostle's not just thinking of what we think of as spiritual things here. I mean, in this last couple of chapters, he's been talking about shopping and eating out. Whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. It has to include my life in the workplace. Well, here's another thought to put into the mix. The glory of God crosses the sacred secular divide. Now, this week I was told the story of the billionaire whose Christian faith and faithful giving and philanthropy are well attested, as is his business interests, which include media companies that distribute pornography. But I was told the story this week that on his way to work, there's a bridge he has to cross. And he's alleged to have said to someone that bridge marks the spot where in the morning his Christian life ends and his business life begins. And on the evening, it reverses. His business life ends and his Christian life begins again. And so if you asked him, why as a Christian are you distributing pornography? He'd say, well, I'm a businessman there. Now, whatever the truth for that man, it's a vivid picture, isn't it, of what happens for many of us. You can probably mark your own equivalent of the bridge. Well, it's not just putting on work clothes, suits or overalls, but it's also putting on a work mindset, a work ethic, a work habits. Whatever you do, do it all to the glory of God. For God, there is no bridge on the way into work. Working for the glory of God, revealing his nature, going public on his worth, isn't restricted either to spiritual jobs. You know, church workers and missionaries, though sadly not all we do is always for the glory of God. It's true of any job. The sacred-secular divide is really often just something in our own imagination. God's glory, God's worth, God's nature can be revealed anywhere. Now, and of course, being a rather sophisticated group, we're far more nuanced. We understand there are kind of Christian vocations to things like medicine and education. In fact, we often have a subtle grading of work, don't we? You know, he's got a job, she's got a career, you've got a profession, I've got a calling. With the BBC just across the way there, the people I spend most time with, apart from the one show which has taken up all of 15 seconds of my life so far, are really the security people there. I'll often chat with them on the way across. There's one guy in particular who heads one of their security teams, and we'll often stop for a brief chat. He's been hugely helpful to us when there have been incidents coming up, and we'll have a bit of a joke. You know, I was telling him how useless his security team were when the tank was parked out there as Stig tried to get Jeremy Clarkson reinstated. But last week, we were just talking because there had been an incident on the piazza, and there'd been trouble where a man had poured petrol over himself. And as he was telling me about him, I said, was he mentally disturbed? He said, you must get plenty of them like that. He was desperate, he said. And then he told me how, he said, the team, they took his lighters off him. They got him into a room. They saved his life. And as he finished, he just said to me, he knows who I am and what I do. He said, like yours, our job is an honourable calling. Great line, wasn't it? He may have been speaking truer than he knew, and contemporary Christianity has often lost the sense of being called to whatever job we're in, of going to work with the mindset of doing it all for the glory of God, to reveal his nature. Now, I don't know whether you have to cross any bridges to get to your workplace, but it's worth having a marker point. Not where your Christian life ends and your business life begins, but where I set my mind to do it all for the glory of God. It may be the most mundane of calibrations that are needed. Actually, just going to work at all reflects the God who made us. The New Testament has some striking warnings for us. Here's one of them. The one who's unwilling to work shall not eat. Not unable to, unwilling to. You know, working to feed my face may not sound the highest of motives, but it is an honourable one. The God who made us to rule his world in Genesis 1 wasn't thinking of the kind of rule where I sit back on my lounger and food and anything else I need is provided for me. He was thinking of a rule where I work and care for the garden and produce from it what's needed to provide for me. We were made for work. We reflect a worker God. Or here's another New Testament warning. Anyone who does not provide for their own relatives and especially for their own household has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. You know, working to put food on the table for my family is a Christian reason for getting out of bed on a Monday morning. We belong to a God who provides for his people. And so should we, where we're able. We need to respect properly those with the kind of tedious, menial jobs that give them few more exciting motivations to drag themselves to work day after day. We need to respect properly those who don't go out to work, but manage a home, care for the children, provide for the family that way, and almost certainly get despised for not having a proper job. We need to learn, we Brits, from the many foreign nationals among us who work in this country and provide for the extended family back home, they live this warning far more seriously than many of us take it. Glorifying God, going public on his nature as a provider God and ourselves made in his image. Or, again, here's another. Anyone who's been stealing must steal no longer, but must work, doing something useful with their own hands, that they may have something to share with those in need. Work to provide, yes, that's one thing. Now here, work to be generous. Christians are to be givers, not takers. And whether it's the meal for the needy neighbor or the sick fellowship group member, or it's the check your salary allows you to write, and don't forget to gift aid it, the expectation is that Christians will be generous. And work makes that possible. I was at a dinner last night for Co-Mission, that church planting group in the southwest of London. They were celebrating 25 years, and it was a remarkable evening. I was talking with one woman, and she was telling me about heavy responsibilities she's got at work. And in many ways, she'd like to lay some of them down, but she says, one of the main reasons I work is so that I can both provide for the family and actually be generous in supporting the gospel ministries we've got going on here. God's glory crosses the sacred-secular divide. When I come across a Christian community, I expect to find a hard-working, providing, generous group of people to see traces of the God they believe in. I might rightly say I don't have to be Christian to show those motivations. True, for the same God made us all. I might say there are higher motivations, and we'll see some shortly. Certainly there are costlier ones, but I shouldn't underestimate these godly reasons for heading into my workplace in a fallen, frustration-dominated world. Nor should I underestimate the shocking change to the system, that lifetime system that educated me to fulfill myself and glorify myself, not glorify God. What a radical reorientation is involved if I cross that imaginary bridge and saying, I'm going to work not for what I can earn, but for what I can earn to give. As I cross my bridge, real or imagined, to my secular workplace, that's just the start of working for the glory of God. Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Now, there are times when we can look at God's story. We can find meaning for our work to reflect his nature and reveal his glory. And it seems easier in some areas than others, doesn't it? Someone said to me only the other day, it's easy for those in the healthcare professions, you know, to see themselves as part of God's healing work. Well, I said, yes, it might be, but it's not that narrow, is it? I said, you know, what about creatives in art and music? Oh, I suppose so. What about truth seekers in the media, I said. Well, I suppose so. I said, what about lawyers? Well, a very different. I mean, lawyers. What can we do? I said, yeah, what about lawyers? Yeah, people who see the importance of justice being done. The horror of being in a society which does not reflect anything of a God of justice. Okay. Or teachers. You know, giving children the tools to explore and flourish in God's world. That one was okay. Money makers, I said. Yeah, but they provide the means, the capital that delivers work and productivity for others. Policemen. I told them about Simon, who'd been a church assistant here and went off to be a policeman because he thought how important it was that society could be made safe for people. You know, you actually, when you start thinking, you can grow it and grow it, can't you? And yet, yeah, it's not with rose-tinted specs on. We live in such a twisted, fallen world that these ideals easily get forgotten, that profit and promotion, to name but two, drown them out. Someone has to keep asking, don't they, how does this actually further justice? Yeah, how does this help us care for patients? How is this profit really serving others? And when you ask the question, you may find no one will listen. We'll need to keep asking ourselves, as one young architect I heard about this week is doing. You know, question she's asking is this: how do you view the built world biblically? The created world of nature, yeah, we've got that. How do you view the built world biblically? And she's trying to think through, how do you design architecture that builds community? We'll need to encourage some who get little of it. I'm not the only one. I try and make a point when I come across a road sweeper here to stop and thank them personally every time. I'm so grateful that someone serves the neighborhood like that. As I cross my bridge, real or imagined, do it all for the glory of God. One more thing to put in the mix. God's glory reveals God's nature. God's glory crosses the sacred-secular divide. God's glory is shown in shame as well as success. Turn with me, will you, back to that reading that Onyeka read for us, to John chapter 12, to page 1080 in the Church Bibles. Page 1080, John chapter 12. And pick it up at verse 23, where Jesus says, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified." And as you read on, it becomes clearer and clearer. He's speaking of his death. He's speaking of his cross. He's speaking of his agony. And he finds glory there. Finds it because he understands its place in God's story, the overarching story of his redemptive history, of our redemptive history, of the world's redemptive history, and the place of the ransoming sacrifice, the rescuer king, the suffering servant whose death redeems his people. Glory is here because God's nature is nowhere more exposed than on the cross. His hatred of sin, his astonishing mercy and grace, his deeply remarkable self-sacrifice. I was hearing the story last night of one family. Husband in the military went off to Afghanistan, I think it was, and the church family took in the wife and two kids and looked after them, found them a council home. When he came back from serving abroad, he joined the church. His father came along, military as well. He too joined the church and was converted. And he said this, "I've done some terrible things in my time. But when I think of what Jesus did for me, it moves me to tears every time." Now, of course, the cross was unique. But it was also a pattern. You know, we imagine working for God's glory leads to success. Well, yes, it took Jesus to the throne room of heaven, but only via the cross. Look on down to verse 27. "Now my soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour?" No. "It was for this very reason I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." You know, we love to speak of success. We speak of those who are sort of managing directors and CEOs and professors and consultants. Jesus glorified the Father's name in the shame and the agony, the mockery and the cruelty, the humiliation of the cross. They saw his character. Enough of God's nature for the thief to cry, "Lord, remember me when you come in your kingdom." For the centurion, that hard-bitten regimental sergeant major who'd seen it all a dozen times before, to say, "Truly, this was the Son of God." "When I'm lifted up," Jesus says, "I'll lift all, draw all kinds of people to myself." Do it all for the glory of God. See, do people see any traces of that self-sacrifice when we face undeserved shame? Do people see the selflessness that puts myself down to serve others, or are we not that kind of team player? Stay late for me, but not for others. Pass the buck rather than face the responsibility. Do it all for the glory of God. When Paul wrote those words to the Corinthians, he wasn't speaking of the cosmic significance of the cross. He was speaking of the details of eating or not eating meat offered to idols. But he talked about renouncing freedoms to serve others, missing out on his stake for love of his brother and sister Christian. God's glory reveals God's nature. God's glory crosses sacred secular divide. God's glory is shown in shame and sacrifice as well as success. That story focused on the cross is unavoidable. Make one last stop with me, will you? Keep on heading back to Matthew's gospel, Matthew chapter 5, page 969. Come to some familiar words which may have just lost their surprise to us. Matthew 5, page 969 and verse 14. And Jesus is speaking to his disciples and he says this in verse 14. Do you see it? You are the light of the world. Now, your memory is not playing tricks. Actually, we can remember the phrase, can't we? Only we normally remember it differently. It was something Jesus said about himself. I am the light of the world. And actually, the more you think about that, the happier I am for Jesus to be the light of the world. It gets worrying when I discover that I'm meant to be the light of the world. And yet, that's what he says here. You, disciples, are the light of the world. Of the world, that light's got to come into the workplace with us. And a city set on a hill can't be hid. And you don't sort of set up a light and then hide it somewhere. It's there for us to see. Look, verse 17. Let your light so shine before others that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. You say, just a moment. They glorify your Father in heaven. I thought we were talking about us glorifying our Father in heaven. No, that is the point. If we live for God's glory, if we live for God's glory so that others will live for God's glory, we will have to tell his story. We will have to tell his story, or they won't make the link. They'll either just think, you are wonderful, which is encouraging but gets you absolutely nowhere if you want people to glorify God. Or more likely, they'll be scratching their heads in confusion and think, I just don't get him at all. What makes her tick? I'll need to tell the story of the God who made and gifted and rescued. I'll need that boldness that Annie was mentioning in her top tips. So Monday morning, crossing the bridge to the workplace. Whatever you do, do it all for the glory of God. Will you be ready? Will you be praying, where are you at work, Lord? Well, we're going to sing of his nature, of his character, of his glory as we sing of the cross. This, the power of the cross. Let's stand and sing together.